Hey, Cubicle to CEO listeners, it's Natasha from the Shine Online Podcast. Listen to the Shine Online Podcast every other Wednesday to learn effective Instagram strategies to leverage video and content marketing to grow your brand. Tune into honest conversations with the brightest entrepreneurs I know, along with learning tried and tested Instagram tactics with the goal of empowering you to do business in a way that feels real to you. Check out Episode 55, how to use Instagram to book your next speaking gig, to learn exactly how to book speaking engagements by leveraging all the surfaces on Instagram, including your bio, profile, content, and so much more, with no prior speaking experience required. You are listening to the Cubicle to CEO podcast. Here's your host, Ellen Yin.
You're listening to the Cubicle to CEO podcast, episode 143. This week's case study reveals how Girls Who Code increased enrollment in their programs by more than 200% during a global pandemic, a jump from 1,600 to 5,000 students enrolled that brought their total students served to over 500,000. We're joined in this interview by Dr. Tarika Barrett, the CEO of Girls Who Code, an international nonprofit organization working to close the gender gap in technology. With over two decades of building educational pathways for young people at organizations like the New York City Department of Education and New York University's Center for Research on Teaching and Learning, along with an impressive list of accolades, including being named one of Crain's 50 Most Powerful Women in New York in 2021, Dr. Tarika Barrett is an expert in education and innovation. Whether you're a course creator, nonprofit leader, or online educator and coach, this conversation will help you impact more lives with the work you do. Welcome to the Cubicle to CEO podcast. I'm your host and marketing minimalist, Ellen Yin. I'm a first-generation Asian-American founder who profitably grew my business to $1 million by age 26, with no funding or debt. Now, I'm on a mission to share what I've learned to help you scale your own impact and income. Whether you're trying to escape an actual cubicle or breaking out of a figurative box that has kept you stuck, we're giving you access to the best and brightest minds in business on our show every Monday. Listen in as these leaders impart their wisdom, inspiration, and encouragement to empower you to become the CEO of your dream business and life. Hey everyone, welcome back to the show. We are so thrilled to have a very special guest with us today, Dr. Tarika Barrett, who is the CEO of Girls Who Code. Tarika, I'm just so thrilled to have you here. It's such an honor. We would love for you to share your Cubicle to CEO story first. Like, how did you become CEO of such an incredible nonprofit? But in addition to that, you know, I would also love for you to share with the listeners just a brief glimpse into the work that you guys do at Girls Who Code in case people are not familiar with your organization.
Yeah, Ellen, it's such a pleasure to be here, and I'm happy to talk to you about my leadership journey. The first thing I have to say is that I'm just so proud to be the CEO of Girls Who Code. You know, we're an organization working to close a gender gap in tech, but, you know, I also bring other perspectives to this. I'm Jamaican American, I'm the proud daughter of immigrants, you know, a Black woman and educator, and so much of that shapes how I approach my work. You know, the quick thing I'll say is that, you know, I stand on the shoulder of generations of inspiration. All these incredible women who got me to where I am today, and I continue to be inspired by our girls and young women who propel me to move this work forward. And, you know, I have so much backstory I can share with you about sort of, you know, how I came to be in terms of my grandmother dropping out of school and working on the family farm, or my mom being the first in our family to go to college and to get a graduate degree. So much of that shapes this moment. But, you know, when I think about the direct through line in terms of being the CEO of Girls Who Code, it's been a deep commitment to issues of equity and access in education my entire career. You know, I always luckily had a mom who instilled in me the importance of kind of going into spaces, seeing the work that needed to be done but wasn't happening, and believing that I had the agency to be the change I wanted to see. And I'll point to like one big kind of professional event that propelled me to kind of say yes to Girls Who Code. remote. And it was very much working at the New York City Department of Education, where, you know, I had a chance to work with kids who, frankly, many people had written off because they were so far behind academically with not a lot of chances to get back on track. And, you know, one of the things we also did was build new schools. And I had a chance to actually lead the team that designed and launched a first of its kind high school focused on software engineering. At the time, it was going to be this big deal, a part of the mayor's plan to make New York City a tech hub. But in that moment, as I led this team, I also learned that it was possibly going to be what we called a quote unquote screened school, which would mean that kids would actually have to test in to be accepted. And as an educator, I knew that if we were going to rely only on test scores, kids of color wouldn't have a shot. They would be at such a disadvantage. And so in that moment, I harnessed my leadership to really, you know, fight against screening, rallying support to open that school to any kid interested in learning programming. And, you know, I'm really proud to say that now any teen in New York City can apply to the Academy for Software Engineering. And for the kids who are there, 95% of them are graduating on time. But I share this story with you, Ellen, because it's such a reminder for me in my own journey that you have to exist at the intersection of bravery and opportunity. And you always have to disrupt the status quo wherever possible, you know. And I think, you know, this is a moment where equity in tech education is possible, where closing the gender gap is actually possible. And I knew I had to be a part of that change. And so, you know, the other thing that's a little crazy, and I know we'll probably talk about this, who says yes to becoming a CEO during a pandemic? Apparently that's me. I raised my hand. And, you know, I'm happy to kind of talk more about why I said yes. But for listeners who want to know just a little bit more about Girls Who Code, as I mentioned, we're, you know, an international nonprofit, and our mission is to close the gender gap in entry-level tech jobs by 2030. And so we are leading this movement to inspire, educate, and equip students who identify as girls or non-binary with the computing skills to take on 21st century opportunities. And we do this through a number of programs. We have Code at Home, as well as our free after-school clubs that really get girls early when they can get excited about computer science. And then we have this array of summer programs that builds on that initial interest and gets girls to consider CS in college. And then, you know, we haven't forgotten about our college students and, you know, our young women going into the workforce. We have programs like our College Loops, our Girls Who Code Talks, our Hiring Summits, and Work Prep that all aim to cement pathways, you know, into tech for young women. By addressing this growing gender gap in tech, we're empowering our young people to really think about the thriving and exciting careers that come with tech, the ones that are going to actually translate into, frankly, the upward mobility and improved quality of life that, you know, come with those kinds of fields. So that's sort of the Girls Who Code in a nutshell.
Wow. I could really listen to you all day, not only because you have the most beautiful voice. I don't know if anyone's ever told you that.
You're so kind.
I hear an audiobook in your future, maybe your own podcast.
Oh my gosh, you're too kind.
But I'm so not only impressed with your story, but your story really makes my heart sing in many ways, Tarika, because I relate so much to your background, being the daughter of immigrants, being an immigrant myself, and, you know, navigating life as a first-generation American, I think, is just such a unique experience, which I definitely relate to in what you're saying there. But also one key point I wanted to pull out just from your own story, I love that you made a note to say, you know, I stand on the shoulders of those who have come before me. And I think you're the first guest to really bring that to light for us. And I think for me, and I would love to hear your take on this too, I've always had, not an issue necessarily, but I've always felt like that term, like, I'm self-made, isn't quite accurate, right? Because even if you are self-driven or you don't come from wealth and you have created, you know, wealth for yourself, which absolutely is, you know, an incredible feat, I do think that it's erroneous to say that you're self-made, because so much of your success comes from your community, right? Your family,
oh my gosh,
your networks, the education system you grow up in, your access to that. So
I'm with you on that. I'm with you on that. And I would, you know, plus one, you're community made, definitely not self-made for me, women made, community made. I have had so many people instill their values. You know, my grandmother graduated, you know, didn't graduate. She had a sixth grade education when she dropped out. And the notion that she, in spite of her education being cut short, could still instill this idea that somehow education could still pry open the doors of opportunity. She did that with her kids in the most subtle and not so subtle ways. And that went all the way down to me in terms of being able to sit where I am now. So I so resonate with everything you just said, because I definitely don't think it's about being self-made. It's very much community-made. And for me, frankly, all the incredible women who've given me so much.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think your story just speaks to the miracle of how much change can happen within just a few generations, right? How
Absolutely.
Different your life looks like compared to your grandmother's life and what she dreamed of as possibilities you made into reality.
Oh my gosh, goosebumps. Two generations later, she would never believe that I would be doing what I'm doing today. So Ellen, that's just a profound statement, and it so touches my heart, because that's definitely my journey.
Want to maximize your marketing dollars for sales? Don't sleep on podcast ads. You all know I believe in making data-driven decisions for my business, and the numbers don't lie. Podcast ads are 4.4 times more effective than display ads for conversions. 67% of listeners remember brands they hear on a podcast, and 63% of listeners make a purchase directly from a podcast ad. That's every one in two people. We all experienced how iOS changes shook up Facebook and Instagram ads recently. So this year, our company has decided to diversify our ad spend by tapping into the power of podcast advertising through Zencastr's creator network. Zencastr makes it so easy for brands to connect with their favorite shows and creators by using context to match you with the right audiences and best podcasts to promote your product. Zencastr's podcast marketplace allows brands and podcasters to negotiate directly, collaborate together, and form long-term relationships. I'm putting my money where my mouth is and actually just invested in my first paid advertising campaign through Zencastr's podcast marketplace. And I'm so impressed with how easy the Zencastr team made the entire setup process for me. With a direct integration to major payment platforms like Shopify and Stripe, we're able to directly track our campaign's performance and conversions right inside our Zencastr dashboard. I can't wait to share more results with you in our upcoming quarterly income report right here on Cubicle to CEO. Interested in sponsoring this show or trying podcast ads for your business? Go to zen.ai/Ellen. That's spelled zen.ai/ELLEN, and fill out the contact information so Zencastr can help you bring your business story to life. Yes. And I know that your story is so inspiring to so many people. And I think at the core of the work that you do with Girls Who Code, making education more accessible and really encouraging women to step into fields that historically have not been well represented by women, right? I'd love to talk to you a little bit more about that piece. And as you all know, if you're listening in, today's case study is really focused on how Girls Who Code, how the organization was able to increase their enrollment by over 200% for their flagship program due to some strategic pivots that they made during the pandemic. And as we dive into that case study, I want to kind of pre-frame this conversation for our listeners by saying, yes, you know, Tarika is an incredible leader for a nonprofit organization. But even if you don't exist in the nonprofit world, so much of the conversation we're going to have today can still be applied to your business if you are in the education space at all. So if you are a speaker, if you are a course creator, if you are a coach or a mentor or anybody who exists to help pass on knowledge and guidance and mentorship, this conversation applies to you. So I just wanted to put that context out there and for you guys to listen with that frame of reference in mind. The first question I have for you, Tarika, is I know that one of the key pivots that you guys made was making your program, your flagship program, more flexible and also accessible by adding in virtual programming, whereas previously it was only in person. I would love to know, A, some context on what that flagship program looked like before and after, but B, the second part of that conversation I really want to understand is, what do you see as the primary obstacles or barriers that are present in accessibility to education, both from an enrollment side, like getting people into the programs, but also on the completion side for students to actually go through the whole program and successfully complete what they set out to do?
Ellen, you asked a lot of important questions, and I will No, I love it. I love it. I'm going to try to get to all of it. I guess I'll just start by saying, you know, I said this before, but I became CEO of Girls Who Code at a really high point in the pandemic, at a time when our students needed us the most. And, you know, this pandemic has frankly exacerbated all of these challenges that we've been working on as an education now for a decade. And it revealed these massive gaps in terms of education and support for our most marginalized students, right? Low-income students, students of color. And you asked me, what did this flagship program look like before? For us, it was our baby, right? The first thing we ever do. Picture the start of Girls Who Code with 20 girls in a borrowed conference room, you know, coding from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. And then that expanded. And at our height pre-pandemic, we were talking about 80 of these programs across the country, you know, girls housed in partner companies, doing the same thing, 1,600 girls total. And then the pandemic hits and we freak out, as every organization and company did, because we're like, wait a second, this is our flagship. This is a thing that we think is deeply transformative. What are we going to do? And, you know, I always say the pandemic gave no gifts, but it really pushed our thinking, Ellen, around what needed to happen. We knew in this moment, right? Understand that half of our community at Girls Who Code comes from historically underrepresented groups. So kids who look like me and grew up just like I did in terms of who we serve. We knew in that moment that they couldn't be further marginalized and sidelined. We had to make sure that not only would they survive, could we help them to thrive? And so the first thing we did was to survey our community. We asked our girls, right, and our young women, what are you experiencing? What do you need? And so, you know, to your point in the framing of your question, we decided to prioritize accessibility and flexibility because we knew that had to be central to the kinds of outcomes we knew we wanted to see with our community. So we're talking about live and asynchronous instruction, project-based learning, group work, because remember that these are girls who have myriad challenges from in unreliable Wi-Fi, computers that we realized that they were sharing or didn't have to begin with, the lack of a quiet place to work, caregiving responsibilities that they were grappling with. And remember, during the pandemic, these were girls, especially if they came from Black and Brown communities, who were grappling with the loss of family members to the virus. So there were all these things that we saw that we knew we had to step in and be able to support. And the headline that you shared that I'm so proud of is that we pushed ourselves. We think we landed on something that's best in class in terms of virtual learning. And the result was that we scaled our program in a way that we would have never done had the pandemic not pushed us to do so. So instead of serving 1,600 girls, we served close to 5,000 that first summer when we pushed ourselves to do that. And frankly, more girls than we had ever served in poor and rural communities, which made us so proud. And for us, it didn't end there because, to be honest, our growth engine hasn't been that flagship because, while wonderful, it was a smaller number of girls. We also thought about how to support our free after-school clubs model where we reach the most girls and students. And it meant helping our facilitators who lead them, giving them resources and tools so that they could run these sessions either in person, remotely, or in a hybrid model. And we just had to keep thinking about how to provide that support. And the truth is, you asked about obstacles and barriers as well as sort of, you know, how you address issues of enrollment and completion. You know, so much of it is just making sure that those supports were actually in place and that our students would be able to, you know, gain this from their facilitators and that we'd be able to equip them with everything that they possibly needed. And, you know, I think that making sure that our outreach team was getting out there and identify girls who needed them the most, that we were looking at Title I schools, that we were constantly thinking about who didn't have access to this. And it's pushed us to even think about self-paced programming, you know, ways in which we can engage even more young people during this time. And so it's been incredibly rewarding, but it didn't, you know, the other thing I would say is that we learned lessons that, okay, we know some girls are going to have to go back to in-person instruction, but we actually think that what we provided was so strong that it will be a model for serving all students, some of whom were never, their needs were never really met in a huge way by in-person instruction. And in terms of our numbers, we, instead of serving 450,000 girls to date, we now can say we've served 500,000, including in growing our alumni base from 90,000 to 115,000. And the other group I want to point to, we surveyed our alums really early in the pandemic because we were very worried about them. And we learned right away that 30% of them had lost their internship opportunities. And 40% of our seniors had their full-time job offers rescinded. That was such a big deal. We also knew we had high numbers in terms of caregiving and other responsibilities, folks who had to stop everything they were doing in terms of their plans to be able to get a job and help their families. That also propelled us, when you talk about lessons learned and how organizations can make pivots, to decide to deepen our work in the college programming as well as workforce development space. It led to us holding our first ever hiring summit. And Ellen, we don't know how to do that. We didn't know how to do that. We know how to do it now. We held a hiring summit, and we actually did two of them. We had 2,000 students and dozens of partner companies come to meet these young women who all of a sudden, remember, don't have access to potential employers the same way that they did, right? Mm-hmm. Also have an incredibly unique set of skills and talents that we want employers to tap into, but don't all sometimes get overlooked. And so, you know, it was just this wonderful move that we made. And we're so happy that we're doing that kind of work in the workforce development space to really help cement pathways into tech for young women.
It is incredible. I mean, truly, the growth in spite of hardship, the number of lives impacted. And like you said, you know, the pandemic, of course, no one wishes that that happened, but it is in many ways has been such a catalyst for innovation and change that I think, you know, has ripple effects for years and decades to come. And, you know, what's interesting about what you said in terms of flexibility. So, you know, you said you started implementing, for example, live and asynchronous learning or teaching. Can you talk to us about what that means? I think a lot of the educators perhaps listening, especially course creators, I'm thinking of particularly, they may be hearing that and going, what does that actually look like? What does that mean?
No, I love that question. It's super pragmatic because if you think about it and you think about how schools are structured, everything is based on that, you know, person, young person or adult being in front of you and getting all of that instruction in a live way. Mm-hmm. That's how we did it for our summer programming. That's what it looked like for our free after-school clubs. It was always predicated on that in-person connection, which we still think is central to that sisterhood, which is a core value of ours. But we had to stop and say, how do we have that core value of sisterhood come to life in a way that allows our community to not have to all plug in at the same time, all, you know, be present? Because we, when we surveyed our girls and young women, we saw tremendous variability. What do you do when one girl is like, I actually have a job and I can't come for the session at that time? Mm-hmm. And another one saying, oh, I can't do it that way. I'd love to participate in this internship, but in fact, I have this commitment. What can I do? You can't say to them, well, you can't fit into our rigid mold of what learning and exposure looks like. You turn it on its head and say, wait a second, how many hours can you give? What would it look like for us to have folks do some of this on their own? That's the asynchronous part, right? And then to come back together for some moments, right, where we can share, and especially around the sisterhood, support one another, make sure that folks get that sense of camaraderie, and it helps build that resilience. How do you do both of those things? And then we added things like advisories or office hours to make sure that we were also catching folks in those gaps. And listen, this is a huge learning endeavor. We're all kind of figuring this out. But one of the things we learned after our first summer of making the pivot with our flagship summer immersion program, we surveyed our girls at the end, and they said they were equally likely to want to pursue a career in computer science after a 2-week virtual experience, same numbers as the 7-week in-person immersion. So that was just so heartening. I have to be honest, I didn't believe it at first. I was like, are you sure? Can you crunch these numbers again? But it was so energizing to know that, yes, you can achieve, you know, similar things through a different modality. And I don't think you sugarcoat and say, well, it's going to be perfect. You're not going to have any bumps in the road. I think that for us, we constantly put in so many safeguards and checks to make sure that our participants are having a good experience along the way, and that we're troubleshooting and making sure that they have, you know, the guidance, the support, the sisterhood they need to be successful.
All right, Tarika is in the hot seat for our lightning round. We're going to ask her 3 quick questions, and whatever comes to mind, just say what comes to mind. All right, question number 1, Tarika, what phone app do you use the most?
Phone app, WhatsApp, does that count?
Yes, any app on your phone. Like, which one do you open and spend the
most time on? Oh gosh, so then I have to tell my real secret. WhatsApp to call my mom, but I use Stylebook to pick out my outfits every day, which I know sounds ridiculous, but it's a catalog of every piece of clothing that I own, every shoe, everything. And this keeps me super creative, and I can pick an outfit every day and also know when I wore it. So it is like my favorite thing to be able to do. I did it during the pandemic because when I was at home, you know, needed to figure out what I was going to do with my brain in addition to working all the time. And I have not regretted that insane project that is now so easy to use.
I feel like we just learned a huge life hack. I've never heard of this app before. I am so excited. Wow. I mean, it is a massive undertaking to catalog your entire wardrobe, but that is so cool. I love that.
Okay, it gets easy after you do it. Like once you do it, then you're just adding it because you know most of the time you can find that piece online and you just take a pic on your phone and add it. It was the ancient pieces of clothing that I'm like, do I really want to catalog this?
Yes.
But I did it.
Well, if you're watching this on video, Tarika looks fabulous today. So now I know your secrets, right? So I'll definitely be downloading the app. Okay, so question number 2. I thought this was a perfect question to ask you, particularly since you're focused in education. Originally I was going to ask you, what is the lowest grade you've ever gotten in a class and like what made that class difficult for you? So if you want to answer it that way, you can. Or you could just answer like, what class did you struggle with most growing up? Because I feel like it's important for people to see that even if you maybe didn't do well academically, it doesn't have to indicate, you know, your future success and what you're able to contribute.
Yeah, no, I will be completely transparent because I think it's sort of ironic given the work that I do now. But when I was younger, I hated math. And I also I remember my high school math, I had a teacher who literally said, raise your hand if you understand it. And it was democracy rules. Like, so of course it created like a terrible situation where no one would confess that they didn't understand what she was talking about. But it also kind of underscored that there are ways to teach and there are ways to teach. And I think the way that we come at coding with our community at Girls Who Code, it tells girls that you don't have to be perfect. You can get it wrong. The whole point of coding is that it's a lot of trial and error. But when girls grow up thinking that they have to be flawless, it's so hard for them to embrace a field where imperfection is completely fine and it's expected as you hone your skills and get better and better at what you do. And so I'm happy to sort of bravely say that I did not love math growing up. I have a PhD now. I run an organization that, you know, teaches girls computer science. So you can totally do that. And I think it's so critical for our girls to know that not every chapter of your, you know, be it academic or professional journey has to be marked with stellar everything. It's okay to fail. In fact, we embrace it and we encourage it to happen as fast as it can so that we can learn and rebuild and do even better.
1000%. And I'll just add as an extra bit of encouragement, you know, in high school, I also did not like math, but I remember like failing physics tests over and over again. And I actually, my degree is a bachelor's of science and I'm not a science girl. And like, even in my professional career, I've never done anything in science, but that's academically what I graduated with a degree. And so I'm just saying anything is possible. Okay, last question. You're crushing this. What are you currently reading? I feel like you probably have a really great book recommendation for us, so I'd love to know.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so the problem is I have multiple books that I'm reading, always a problem. I want to say it's called, one was a colleague who gave it to me. I think it's Olga Dies Trying, which I might be reading. I hope I'm not getting that title wrong. But because I'm also a sci-fi buff, I am rereading Rosewood by Tade Thompson, which is really good. It is alien invasion set in Nigeria. So I want to throw that one out there.
Whoa.
And then I always try to have like something in my bag that keeps me a little bit meditative and grounded. And the name of that one is escaping me. But those are the ones that I have kind of open and am moving through right now.
I love that. I feel like we just got, you know, bonuses because we have multiple recommendations. I'm the same way, by the way. I feel like I skip around in books. I'll read a couple chapters of one, dive into another. I feel like it's just like I can't like focus on one.
Yeah, I know. It's so hard when you want to like just have, anyway, variety.
Variety, exactly. I love it. Thank you so much.
Oh, a pleasure.
That was super helpful. And, you know, you've brought up this concept of surveying and market research, listening, right? Getting community feedback. I think that piece cannot be overlooked because it seems like a core piece of really your approach to all the work that you guys do at Girls Who Code is listening to the people who are actually going to be benefiting from your programs, right? Mm-hmm. So I would love to know in the beginning when you were sending out these surveys to your alumni and to your current, you know, younger students, how are you reaching them? Were you sending them email surveys? Can you give us any glimpse into like, I guess what I'm trying to ask is I think there may be listeners who think, oh, like this is a missing piece for me and my business. I'm not reaching out and really surveying people and understanding what their needs are, but then they may feel overwhelmed by the prospect of, you know, what is the best way to survey people such that I will actually receive, a large volume of feedback.
Yes, responses.
Exactly. So what are the practices in terms of like the channels through which you reach them? How did you structure, you know, either the length or the content of the forms? Did you follow up with anyone one-to-one over calls? Anything you can share there would be great.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think one of the things we've been deeply blessed by is a community that we have a strong connection to that have a strong sense of affinity, you know, with Girls Who Code. The sisterhood has been so good to us. And when we tend to put our feelers out and ask, we do have responses. But the thing I would say to your listeners is also, who are the stakeholders you're trying to get? For us, because of the nature of our programming, we do have multiple stakeholders. In some cases, it could be the facilitators running clubs who we might reach out to and ask very pointed questions about what are your needs? What do you need to be successful? What does enrollment look like right now? Are you even able to host your club? So there was a wealth of information that we could get from the front lines folks who were actually running clubs. But then when it came to the alumni data that I shared with you, that absolutely required outreach to alums. And historically, we tend to use two modalities, depending. But we sometimes send surveys via email very often. But we also have found, believe it or not, depending on your audience, text messaging is super useful as a way to get people to respond really quickly to something that you want. And I think less is always more in the way of surveys, because we had hunches and we used the surveys as a way to refine those. Of course, you're always hoping to gain new information or a new perspective that you weren't contemplating, but a lot of it was already suspecting the ways in which our community would have needs around Wi-Fi, computers, access, quiet place to work. Where the survey became deeply critical from a programmatic perspective was figuring out, for example, when we wanted to launch our work prep program, it became really hard to figure out. This was something that we were going to partner with a company that would host these young women in a virtual way, and figuring out what time of, like, when could you do this program? Are you on spring break? Are you not? Do you have the time? Are you working? So that became really critical to land on something that was going to be really effective. And I think be iterative. Don't be afraid to send it again. And the other thing that's really critical that we sometimes leverage would be incentives. Right? Mm-hmm. We might say we want to hear from you and we have a gift card, or we want to do some other way to celebrate you as you give us critical information to allow our program to be successful.
That's really interesting. And I just want to echo what you said about SMS messaging, text marketing, right? It is such an underutilized, but so
such a powerful channel. I mean, if you think about it, just even in your anecdotal day-to-day life, you're much more likely to open a text than probably an email, because email, you know, you get a mix of personal communication, business communication, and a lot of spam. So it's easy to overlook. It's easy to overlook the pile in your inbox, but it's much less likely that you are going to overlook the texts that come into, you know, to your phone, because it's traditionally a channel that you kind of reserve for people you actually know, right? Who are actually texting you with their numbers. So
exactly.
I think that's really brilliant. With text, just one follow-up question on the text messaging. When you would send out, you know, like you said, a simple, short and sweet text, would you just ask like one specific question, and then if they answered, follow up with the next one? Or was it like a series of questions like, what are the greatest barriers for you to, you know, participate in the program, et cetera, and all at once?
Yeah. I mean, we've used a platform that allowed us to, I think, ask a bunch at once, but I would have to kind of talk to the team specifically about what they used for this round. Again, I think we've also, it depends on where your folks are, because I would say our alums, because they're kind of plugged into that college space or that workspace, being able to reach them by email is completely within the flow of what they would mm-hmm. do. Whereas for our students, especially as we wanted to verify information about, you know, enrolling in the program, making sure that they were ready for day one, text messaging can be so vital, because it's like just in time, easy to respond really quickly, and keeping those answers, questions really brief, meant that we would get exactly the information that we needed.
Awesome. That insight is really helpful. And by the way, if you're listening to this and you're totally new to text messaging as a channel for your business, a great platform that we personally use in our business that we recommend is Norby. So I'll just throw in, you know, a little insert here so that you guys can learn a little bit more about their software program. Norby has been a game changer for my business since we started using it 9 months ago. A way to directly text my community means higher live show up rates, more podcast downloads, tracked links, and a way to identify our biggest brand advocates who are sharing our content with their friends. Norby was built for busy creators and business owners like you and I who are juggling way too many marketing tools. Norby puts your link in bio, SMS texts, newsletters, events, and landing pages all in one place, lets you customize every detail to make them just right for your brand, and makes everything work beautifully together. Their plans start at just $5 a month. For the price of a coffee, the return on investment is a no-brainer. To redeem a 2-week free trial, no payment method required, and experience the power of Norby yourself, go to ellenyin.com/Norby. That's spelled Norby. Pro tip, if you add a payment method anytime during your 2-week trial, totally up to you, Norby will add an extra free month to your trial. So you'll actually get 6 uninterrupted weeks completely free. If you like to be an early adopter of innovative tech, this is your chance. Use my link to skip the invite waitlist and start creating right away. Sign up for your free trial in just 30 seconds at ellenyin.com/Norby. The link will also be below in the show notes. Tarika, so continuing on with the actual strategy of enrollment. So obviously you've talked us through from a programmatic standpoint how you guys were able to make changes that ultimately increased your enrollment. But I'm curious, do you think that the 200% increase in enrollment was driven solely by the changes in programming? Or do you feel like you also implemented creative marketing initiatives that brought in new enrollments from people who perhaps had not heard of Girls Who Code before? I'm thinking specifically of, you know, for example, the really creative partnership that you guys did with Doja Cat and for Girls Who Code. Like, was that a part of the strategy that allowed that enrollment increase, or did that kind of come after and you feel like most of this increase was attributed to your programming changes?
Yeah, well, listen, I am excited to talk about Doja Cat always, but that came after, in fairness, although all of it helps and contributes to that. I think for your listeners, especially as you're thinking about, you know, their organizations or companies, one of the big things for us with, you know, that enrollment we talked about, the biggest obstacle for us in scaling had to do with geographical like restrictions and boundaries, because the way that our program was designed was that, you know, we would find girls in a given community near a partner company. And it was all about making sure that we could kind of fill that classroom with that partner in a specific geography. When COVID hit, all of those geographical barriers fell away. And it was deeply liberating being able to say, oh my goodness, your partner classroom is going to have girls from here, and they're going to come from all over the country, which of course our corporate partners loved because they want that exposure too. It was also a way, you know, our international programming, we had to scale back expansion during COVID, given all the constraints. But we also, for the first time ever, opened up that summer programming to international students. And it was incredible to also know that we had international students alongside, you know, domestic students learning. So that was absolutely powerful. And for us, you know, our marketing continues to be predominantly grassroots in terms of staff members in different communities, making sure to find our girls who most need these, this kind of programming. So we're talking about community centers, libraries, nonprofit organizations, especially as we try to reach more Black and brown girls, girls from historically underrepresented backgrounds. And so that work very much happens in that way. But to your earlier point about Doja Cat, we also, in addition to working so hard to, you know, teach more girls computer science, we are constantly leading culture campaigns that are all about changing the face of who belongs in tech, because we know that girls and parents aren't going to be jazzed about our programs if they don't see a place for their daughter within the industry. And so much of the things that we have done over the years, be it our partnership with Penguin, right, to launch a book about, book series rather, about women in tech aimed at babies through middle schoolers, or for example, we partnered with American Girl to launch a gamer doll named Courtney, or with Lizzo, that blew my mind. I was like, this is not happening. And who created an inspirational music video for our girls. You know, we've worked with Lyta Hill, you know, around Missing Code, where we showed what the internet would look like if there were no female coders. And then right before Doja, we did this incredible campaign called Make That Change with a bold new message for girls and young women that, you know, when you pursue a career in tech, you can not only make the change you want to see for your community and the world, but you can change your personal and financial trajectory too. And it was this glamorous, amazing campaign where, you know, girls could see young women who were in tech who looked fabulous and were also doing really fabulous things and changing the world. And then, of course, the culminating thing of this past year, which finally gave me credibility in the eyes of my teenage kids, was the Doja Cat collaboration. You know, think about it. There's no world in which, as a nonprofit, you think you're ever going to be collaborating with Doja Cat, but it was Doja Code, the world's first ever codable music video, which was just incredible. You can just imagine. So it's her viral sensation woman. And you can go in, you know, when you do this, you can change the color of her nails. You can change the background. You can have her appear out of thin air. And you do it by through basic code. And so being able to give so many more girls that notion of, huh, I never thought about doing that, or I never saw myself doing that. Being able to collaborate with Doja on this was incredible. We've had over 300,000, you know, views, and I think already over 3 million coding projects. It's just, it's our wildest dreams come true. And we are so grateful that we were able to put, you know, tech front and center and kind of tell everyone, like, you belong. This is going to be a path that you should pursue, especially because of what it means for upward mobility, improved quality of life. All of that is possible in terms of careers in tech. And we want our girls and young women to have that.
That is so cool. And I could not agree more that you can't be what you can't see, right? That's so right. It's like when others can present to you, oh, this was a possibility for me, suddenly a door opens, an aha moment goes, oh, I didn't know that that was a path for me, but this is a possibility that I can pursue, which is actually, you know, we just went through a brand refresh here at Cubicle to CEO, and our new tagline is pursue what's possible. And I feel like what you just shared there is so in line with that. And for our listeners, I just want to pull a key takeaway from what Tarika shared, which is that, you know, so much of the exposure to new students, new parents who could benefit from Girls Who Code and their programs comes from reaching these young women where they already exist. So it's not them, you know, just trying to, I guess, like only rely on cultivating their own audience. It's going into audiences that have already been built for them. So this concept of borrowed traffic that I talk a lot about in marketing, and thinking even outside the box, like with Doja Cat, right? She already has such a loyal following and such a loyal audience. And so being able to think about, okay, the viewers who are already engaging with that music and that content, right? How do we tap into something that's already relevant to them and then build off of that by offering this new way to engage with something that they already enjoy engaging with? And I think that is my key takeaway from what you just shared, is thinking about, okay, what are brands or what are personalities that are maybe not necessarily directly related to offer, right? Because music is not necessarily directly related to code, but how can you partner with people who have that parallel, that, you know, that parallel in terms of sharing a similar audience? How can you work with those people and those partners or those brands to reach the right audience? So I love that.
I would agree. And I think for us, it was also about reminding our community that they're creative, right? They're passionate about what they care about. They're the incredible change makers. And so, you know, sometimes I think we still have this weird dichotomy where you can either be, it's tech for harm or tech for good. Nothing in between, right? Especially when you think about sort of these male leaders who are out there kind of using tech, frankly, for personal whim and for things that they want to do. And our girls and young men see that, right? And they think to themselves, I don't want to be that. And so for us, it's being able to hold up a Doja or hold up someone else and say, no, you really can follow your passions and your creativity and change the world while also being in tech and doing the incredible things. And we know we need their diversity of perspective because of the way that tech touches every intersection of our lives, right? Healthcare, politics, safety. We need to make sure that our girls and young women have a seat at the table, because tech is as good as the diverse group of people who are building it. And I can give you countless examples of where that has gone terribly wrong. And we know that when we have, you know, the voices of our community, that's going to continue to change, and tech will actually represent the needs of the communities that use it, which is critical.
Absolutely. And I think it was even interesting, one of the initiatives that you know, just briefly mentioned that we didn't really dive deeper on, but that really intrigued me when I was listening, is, you know, your initiative that you talked about, like, what would a world look like without the women who code? Like, if we were to remove all the code that had been created by women, what would the internet, what would our experience in the world look like? That's so interesting. How were you able to pull that off? I'm just curious, like, from a simulation perspective, like, what would that look like?
I wish we could pause and show everyone the video. So we kind of made sure, more than anything, Ellen, that we were asking that provocative question, right? Because we forget, you know, you said it, you can't be what you can't see. We say it all the time at Girls Who Code. Girls grow up learning about Albert Einstein, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, Steve Jobs, all these folks, not the Katherine Johnsons and the Ada Lovelaces or all these incredible women pioneers. And so in terms of how we came at this whole missing code video with Lyta Hill, was that we definitely knew our audience. And so it was all about, you know, a younger audience kind of looking at a screen that was frankly busted, right? Like, all of a sudden the letters fell off, you know, messages that you were trying to send were getting cut off. We used really nice visual representations of, like, you know, common things that happen to you when you have an internet problem, but layering on more and more images, and especially images of girls and women, so that we could kind of underscore that the contributions of women to tech are so many and frankly not seen and undervalued. But in this moment, we're going to put it right there and say, Girls Who Code, like, make sure you understand that women have a place here. And so we think it was really effective and cut through.
That is so powerful. I'm curious, is there a link that your team could send over after that we can
absolutely
include?
Okay. Absolutely. I'm sure we can send that to you. I mean, be careful what you ask for. Then I'm going to send you Lizzo, Doja, Lyta Hill, everything. We'll send you everything.
Okay, wonderful. If you are listening to this right now, please, like, take a moment to scroll below in the show notes and click and watch all of these incredible initiatives, because I think if anything, regardless of your own personal interest in code or tech, right, this is going to teach you how to think outside of the box in terms of how you reach your ideal audience, how you can present information in a new and engaging way. And I think that, you know, for me personally, I love getting to see what other people create. It sparks so many ideas in me. So thank you for those resources. I'm so excited to share them with our community. I feel like it would be a disservice also not to talk about not only the impact that, you know, increased enrollment has had in the lives of your students, but also how it has, I'm assuming all this newfound interest has attracted more partners, whether it's corporate partners, sponsors, just community supporters and advocates. How has your, I guess revenue may not be the right word because it's a nonprofit, but you know, our promise on the show is that you as listeners, when you show up each week with our guests, you're going to learn one specific revenue growth strategy for your business. And I think what Dr. Barrett has shared today is absolutely in line with how you can better shape your programming to increase enrollment, which of course then increases your business revenue. But from a nonprofit perspective, what were some of the positive impacts you saw in increase both financial and perhaps other types of support that your organization received?
Yeah, such a great question. I think that, you know, as I mentioned, I became CEO during the pandemic. And, you know, with a shift in leadership, you know, our incredible founder and predecessor transitioning, you know, to chair of the organization at that time, even though she has a different role now, it was a lot, right? And anyone who is listening to your show, you know that leadership transitions are among the hardest things that companies and organizations have to go through, and that revenue is often very much top of mind, even for nonprofits. And one of the big things that we were really worried about was COVID. And we even experienced really early in the, you know, everything was uncertain. And we saw some of our key partners, you know, worry about being able to renew in a particular way because they were regrouping as everyone tried to figure out what was happening. I am proud to report, however, that things have remained incredibly strong financially for the nonprofit, which I feel like we are so blessed. And I do think that some of it has to do with how you tell the story of your impact and how you tell the story of, frankly, the innovation, the pivots that we've been able to make to be responsive to the needs of our community. I think it's also making sure that folks understand your work and its relevance at a time when there's so much noise in terms of competing need and how folks are getting at a given problem. I would point to two things that I think were immensely promising in terms of partner support, both in terms of just like, yay, go, and like, we want to fund you to do more of this. I think the scale that you talked about, Ellen, in terms of being able to pivot a program that served 1,600 girls to, you know, over 5,000 girls was a big move. I think being able to even go one step further and think about self-paced programming as another, you know, aspect of virtual work, offering even more advanced coursework, is something that partners remain very interested in understanding and supporting. But the thing that probably won't surprise you is that a lot of our partners are particularly excited about our work that's closest to the pipeline for them. Because when we heard that our, you know, alums were losing internships and jobs and that we stepped into that gap in a powerful way, our corporate partners understood how important that was, you know, for the work that they believe in and the mission that they're aligned with, but frankly, also for their bottom line too. The more that they support what we're doing, the more they're going to have the talent that they want to see. Mm-hmm. And for me, in my role as CEO, it's developing programs that very much are about workforce development and get our community those entry-level jobs and beyond. But it's also a conversation about shifting hearts and minds about who belongs in tech, pushing our corporate partners to broaden their scope around who they look for in terms of a quote-unquote qualified candidate, or pushing them to think about academic credentialing and not being overly reliant on that because they keep leaving talent on the table. You know, we talk about it all the time, but that hiring summit with 2,000 of our students, if we were using the traditional sort of tech qualifications for these students, many of them would have been completely overlooked because of the over-reliance on, you know, certain credentials or an Ivy League background. You know, I myself went to a City University of New York school for undergrad alongside other kids from working class families. I wouldn't have a shot when you think about this. And so much of it is opening up that conversation and really pushing our companies to think very differently about that. But together, I really do think that so much of it, Girls Who Code, we pride ourselves on being deeply innovative and responsive and being able to be in open dialogue with our partners so that they understand the pivots we're making and why it's critical that they continue to support us financially to be able to drive the kinds of outcomes that we want to see. And I think, you know, things like the fact that we've been able to pilot work prep internship programs for young women or have 2,000 young women at a hiring summit, all of those are indicators of being deeply responsive to a problem. And so I think they've really supported that.
Incredible. I feel like my biggest takeaway from you today, honestly, is that all the work that you do is so collaborative and so rooted in open dialogue, like you just mentioned. And I think that this is such an important lesson for all of us, especially as business owners, especially for many of our community members who may be listening in and work as a solopreneur, right? Where you're kind of, it's you, yourself, and I, right? Like in your space every day. It's really easy to start creating in a vacuum, right? Where you don't really consider the feedback of anyone other than what's existing between, you know, your two ears and your brain. And so I think that if you can learn anything from Tarika today and the work that Girls Who Code have been able to successfully implement to increase their enrollment, I think it's just looking at what opportunities do you have to ask the right questions to the people that you're serving, to all stakeholders, like you mentioned, whether it's just your clients and students or whether it's other people who have some sort of involvement in your business. How can you bring them into that creation process, and how can you reach more people also through those strategic partnerships? So thank you so much for just that wisdom and insight that you've shared. And I just have to say, I'm going to put this out as a request, maybe it'll happen someday. But one thing you mentioned about, you know, how we grow up learning about, like you said, like Steve Jobs and Albert Einstein. I honestly didn't really even think about that, but you're right. Like so many of the names that you mentioned, I've never really had any education on right. their contributions. And it reminded me of a film I'm sure you saw, Hidden Figures.
Absolutely.
Yes. I love that movie. And I feel like there should be a film made about women coders, like tech, like let's create a Hidden Figures for that, this particular, you know, industry. I think that would be just such a cool project to see in the future.
Of course. And we use Hidden Figures all the time because, you know, so we have this beautiful office and mm-hmm. one of our rooms is named after Katherine Johnson, the mathematician, right?
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
It's central in that. And then you have Mary Jackson, who's also in that. We actually create women in tech spotlights. And so part of what our curriculum includes is that every time that our girls come together in community or our non-binary students, they learn about a woman in tech because, as you said, you can't be what you can't see. And so that sisterhood is also central, that constant reminder, like women before you have done it, you will continue to do it because this wasn't always the case in the 1980s. Women all made up almost half of the computing industry. So mm-hmm. this is a trend we absolutely can reverse. And so I'm so glad you mentioned that because we're constantly elevating incredible women in tech so that our community can see them.
That's beautiful. Well, my final question to you today, Tarika, besides asking, you know, where others can support the work that you all are doing at Girls Who Code, my final question for you specifically is, what does being a CEO mean to you?
Oh my gosh. In this moment, I can say that being a CEO means for me that our girls see me. I said yes to this opportunity because I knew what it would mean for a Black woman to lead, you know, one of the most incredible, you know, girls organizations on the planet. And so for me, being CEO is visibility. Mm-hmm. For me, it's the hope that I inspire others and to let them know that they can be doing whatever they're doing right now, have whatever background they have right now, but it does not define what they can do in the future.
I love that answer. Representation is so important. Thank you so much, Tarika. And as a last thought to our listeners, where can they find Girls Who Code and support the work that you guys are doing?
Yeah, please visit us at girlswhocode.com. We have resources there, you know, for any girl or student who identifies a girl or non-binary, so they can take advantage of that. You can figure out ways to bring a Girls Who Code club to your community. You can support us financially by donating. There's so much there. So please feel free to visit our website.
Amazing. Make sure to check that out. And again, a reminder to check out the show notes for all of those incredible links and ideas that you can take from the creative work that Girls Who Code has put out into the world. Thank you so much for your time, Tarika.
It was such a pleasure, Ellen. I really enjoyed it.
Did you know we offer transcripts for our podcast episodes now? If you loved today's episode and know you'll want to refer back to a written copy that is easy to scan for your favorite quotes and takeaways, visit ellenyin.com/blog on your computer and search the name of this episode in the search bar located on the right-hand side of the page to find the corresponding blog post and download today's episode transcript. We hope this free bonus resource helps you better retain what you've learned. Thank you again for tuning in to the Cubicle to CEO podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can help support this podcast in one of three ways. One, post a screenshot of this episode to your IG story and tag me at Miss Ellen Yin so I can repost you. Two, share this podcast with a friend. And three, leave a positive review on Apple Podcasts so we can continue to grow and reach more listeners. Please make sure to also subscribe so you don't miss out on new weekly episodes coming to you every Monday. And friends, until next time, keep dreaming big.